WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for WGTD's morning show also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, right about now, if Mother Nature had cooperated, we would be introducing you to a very special morning show guest by the name of Herman Mashaba, a very influential and much admired entrepreneur in the nation of South Africa, who was to come to Carthage College at the invitation of the Clawson Center for World Business, and was to speak to the public last night and to join us on the morning show. Unfortunately, 68 inches of snow in Boston ended up changing those plans quite drastically. And Mr. Mashaba, unfortunately, was not able to make the journey to Carthage as scheduled. So for the morning show today, we instead are going to be speaking with two gentlemen who would have been serving as his faculty hosts, so to speak, on the Carthage campus. We're happy, first of all, to have back Dr. Art Seer, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business and Director of the Clawson Center. And also with us today, Yuri Maltsev, Professor of Economics at Carthage College, back quite recently from his most recent trip to South Africa. And so we're going to be talking with both of them a little bit about Mr. Mashaba and kind of the drama which unfolded with the cancellation of this very high-profile visit and what's sort of being done in the wake of these drastically changed plans. We'll hear a little bit from Professor Maltsev, especially about his own experiences in South Africa and the continent of Africa overall. And in whatever time remains after all of that, we will also take the opportunity to speak a bit about the turbulent nation of Ukraine and Russia and their continuing tensions, and find out a little bit about what that situation appears to be at the moment. So, Professor Yuri Maltsev, Professor Art Seer, a warm welcome to both of you on this Tuesday morning.
Oh, thank you, Greg.
Good to have both of you here. Let's actually get the logistics out of the way, this change in plans. Professor Maltsev, you were saying that a lot had been laid in place for this big visit. What had been planned?
Oh, yes. Well, yesterday was planned a public lecture by Herman Mashaba at Carthage, and we had a very enthusiastic response, both from students, from faculty, from community people. There were some people interested, and they got information about this lecture. They were planning to travel from Rhinelander, from Madison, from Oconomowoc to this public lecture. Fortunately, because when we realized that Mr. Mashaba would not be able to make it, that we could at least warn them that the lecture is canceled. Then Mr. Mashaba was supposed to do today to visit many classes, to have a lunch with the faculty, and tomorrow to visit more classes. And then after the last class of his visit, then we were supposed to fly to Washington, D.C., and he would be briefing senior federal executives on the situation in South Africa, on the business environment, on the socioeconomic policies of that great country.
And so all of that's up in smoke, so to speak, or up in snow? I mean, in other words, is it impossible for him to come at all?
Hopefully he can make it today. And he is so frustrated. Can you imagine? He's stuck in this airport hotel in Boston, Logan International Airport, and he couldn't, yesterday he was almost crying, he couldn't even go for a walk because it was such a snow blizzard that it was impossible to just to to get out of the hotel. So it was very frustrating. Can you imagine to make all the way from South Africa and be stuck in Boston? So it is frustrating. But we hope to have him some other time. Because the good thing is that he was visiting the United States not only because of the visit to Carthage, but because his wife, Connie, whom I also very privileged to know, she is a PhD student in Harvard University. And so that's why we have kind of a very dear hostage of his. So he will be visiting United States again.
So in other words, he has other reasons to visit besides his friendship with you.
That's right. That's right. Yes.
Very good. So we can hope that this conversation will still occur. Professor Sear, can you just say a word about once it was clear that he was not able to come? I mean, what plans had to be undone? That had to be no small feat, I'm sure.
Well, of course, this program, we had to make alternate arrangements, and thank you very much. The public lecture had to be postponed, as Yuri indicated, and there were a series of class visits. Our administrative assistant, Deborah Usinger, at the center, is extremely effective at putting these schedules together, and she's equally effective at very efficiently and skillfully dealing with the faculty involved. So These things do happen in life.
And of course.
Mr. Mashab is an experienced businessman, and he's not as used to snow as Professor Maltsev especially, but also you and me. But flexibility is essential to success, especially in business.
Sure. And unfortunately, a dinner had to be canceled, and a limousine had to be canceled, all kinds of...
Postponed.
Postponed, that's
all. Comrade, think of this as postponement.
The P word, not the C word. Okay, very, very good. Professor Maltsev, tell us about when you first became acquainted directly with Hermann Mashaba.
Well, I met Hermann first maybe 4 years ago. And at that time, he was chairman of the board of the Free Market Foundation of South Africa. Hermann Mashaba is a very successful entrepreneur. My wife, Rita, is right now taking a class in management, in principles of management. And amazingly enough, that he is quoted there in her textbook. There's in the leadership section of Principles of Management, 6th edition, there's a story of Hermann Mashaba and his company, Black Like You. He started this company in 1970s during the dark period of apartheid. That was a hair care product company. At that time in South Africa, they were the black people were completely ignored not only by the government but by the market as well. And so he was the one who introduced hair care products, who introduced a lot of products of personal hygiene. And his wife Connie, she's also a very effective entrepreneur, and today she is the president of the Black Like You company. And I met her first in the island of Mauritius 2 years ago. We were speaking at a conference called Africa Rising. Africa Rising, because many people do not realize that Africa at last is rising, that today economic growth in African countries is higher than economic growth in Europe, in North America, and in Asia. So some countries of Africa, like Zambia, for example, Tanzania, Kenya, they are doing very well. Mauritius, Botswana, they're star performers in today's global economy.
Wow. I'm astonished to hear that, although as you name those specific countries, it's a little less surprising because we hear about at least some of their success. But I think you're absolutely right that as a whole, we tend to still think of so much of the continent of South Africa as largely impoverished and to some extent even backward, just not on board when it comes to the modern world. We just don't think of that continent in those terms.
Yes, there was so many economic failures in Africa and in sub-Saharan Africa, especially during 1960s and 1970s, because the continent very uncritically embraced the model of Soviet socialism. And I think that Moscow should be blamed for a lot of economic failures and a lot of economic problems created in countries like Tanzania by, say, Julius Nyerere, or Zambia by Kenneth Kaunda, and in Ghana by Kwame Nkrumah. That were all people who were very much under the influence of Marxist socialism. And they were trying to customize this model, this economic model for African countries, and they failed miserably. Hmm. And Africa in 1970s, 1980s became poorer in many cases than it was under colonialism. And so today African countries are recovering from that. So it's kind of like a failure of the Soviet Union happened in 1991, and now Africans are awakening from that, the same kind of disease which ruined, say, Soviet Union, because the country I was born and raised is Russia. Russia is the, if you know, it's the biggest country in the world. Today it's 9 time zones. It was 11 time zones under the Soviet Union. Could be the richest country in the world, completely ruined by bad economic policies. And so today in Africa, they promote economic freedom. They promote human rights. They promote the respect to business people, providing very favorable business environment, especially countries like Botswana or Mauritius. And we see economic growth 7, 8, 9, 10%. Even Democratic Republic of Congo, which was a basket case until quite recently, today is, recovering very fast from that neglect, from that period of civil wars and turmoil that it was swamped by in 1980s and even the beginning of 1990s.
What would you say are the most important factors which have prompted this rebirth in so many countries in the African continent? What forces have sort of combined to bring this about?
I think that there's a kind of two major issues here. One is that the generation of old Marxist leaders who were trained and educated in Moscow, they were either retired or replaced by younger people who are very technology savvy, people who were already learned their economics and their business in best universities of North America and Europe. And so I think that's one of the reasons. Another reason is that they, to tell you the truth, they've tried almost everything else and it didn't work.
And so that's Plan F or Plan G is what they're on now.
That's
wow.
Right.
I assume that when we speak about Africa, should we be careful to not sort of draw all of these different countries together? I mean, obviously, Africa is a huge continent. I don't remember.
56 countries.
Right. And so I'm sure there are exceptions to what you have just spelled out. And yet you are speaking in terms which seem to indicate that, for the most part, this resurgence of economic well-being is really occurring throughout the continent, if not in every single country.
That's right. Unfortunately, there are plenty of very sad exemptions from this rule. One is Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe, which was a breadbasket for sub-Saharan Africa, one of the most successful countries in Africa, the country which was a major exporter of food and major exporter of mining products, today was completely destroyed by its Marxist government, by Robert Mugabe, who is already a dictator in Zimbabwe for 34 years.
No.
He engineered inflation recently of about 10 billion%. Can you imagine? That I'm showing in my classes, Zimbabwe currency, which is $150 trillion, that you can and the students are asking what you can buy with $150 trillion. Well, you can buy something like a tomato, for example. You can buy maybe if you add two notes, 300, then you can buy a Coke bottle. But that's the major problem, and you can see the spillover effect of these failed countries on their neighbors. In South Africa, there's so many illegal immigrants from Zimbabwe, people who are trying to survive, who are really, I would say, very hardworking people. You can see Zimbabweans almost everywhere, except Zimbabwe itself. In Zimbabwe, it is really very sad. And it's amazing that you can see countries like, say, Zimbabwe and Botswana, the countries with a common history. Both of them were British colonies. Both of them are populated by more or less the same, ethnically the same tribes of people who had a lot of common culture and common history. And one is a star performer. I can just give you numbers that in Botswana, gross domestic product per person is about $28,000 per year, while in Zimbabwe, the people of the same origin are getting less than 1,000. So 28 times less in one country rather than another. Zambia, next country, which was called Northern Rhodesia under the British, it is recovering from its Marxist legacy of Kenneth Kaunda, and now they have economic growth 9 to 10% per year, and they tripled their incomes just in this, in the beginning of the century. So during the last 14 years, can you imagine that the people had saw their wealth increased threefold?
Wow.
So that's the best, I would say, laboratory for a comparative economist to see what works and what does not.
Hmm.
It's kind of the live illustration to Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, why some countries are rich and why some countries are poor. And you can see that Adam Smith was absolutely right, that the only source of this wealth is human freedom, human freedom, which is the basis for human creativity and entrepreneurship.
Hmm. You mentioned the fact that in some respects, one of the major catalysts of this is the literal dying away or the falling away of the old guard who adhered to Marxist principles of leadership, that giving way to a younger generation who, among other things, are more aware of modern technology and that kind of thing. So, for instance, when one travels to Africa, and maybe South Africa, but also even some of these other countries you've been naming, what does one find when it comes to things like access to the internet and so on, and the availability of such technological tools for the average citizen? Again, I think most of us, you know, in our American haze, think of Africa as a backward and antiquated continent for the most part, and I'm sure you're about to tell me that that is not at all the case anymore.
And it is not, yes, Greg, absolutely. Well, I was in South Africa until, a week ago with 40 students. And you know that today's students are very technologically savvy, and they all are looking into their devices, as usual. And so they were trying to connect to internet everywhere, including national parks, including, they can imagine, they see elephants from the bus, and they're trying to find the internet connection. And I would say that's a mixed kind of bag, in the sense that still many countries, even in Europe, I would say, are well behind the United States in internet access. In South Africa, we had some places with a very good internet access. Sometimes the places which are so far away from kind of civilized so-called world. But in some places, like, for example, a first-class hotel in Cape Town, internet was not doing well because South Africa has a lot of problems that they created quite recently. One is blackouts. Blackouts, they would take anywhere from 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 hours. And there's blackouts because the electric grid is not up to date.
Oh.
Because it's a government monopoly. They should diversify. They should definitely introduce competition into the energy sector. Because today people are getting stuck. For example, we were in this first class hotel, Ritz, in Cape Town, and there was a blackout, and I lived, my room was on the 21st floor. And can you imagine for me to carry my luggage on the 21st floor without a helicopter or elevator available? So that's pretty bad. One of the trips before, we were stuck on the top of the Table Mountain in Western Cape Province, on the top of the mountain for 7 hours.
Oh, my God.
For 7 hours. And we were at least lucky that we were stuck on the top of the mountain because some people were stuck in a cable car. Can you imagine if you are stuck in a cable car for 7 hours without, I'm sorry to say, the toilet, without water, without anything, without electricity?
Wow.
So these are the problems. And definitely internet, when you have a blackout, internet does not work as well.
And you know what you're saying is also probably important for us to know that when we are talking about something that for many years has been severely neglected, that is not turned around in a day. I mean, you can even decide we must change this, we must repair this, whatever, but it takes time to, in a sense, undo such a long-lived legacy.
It takes time, and definitely takes some important policy decisions. And that's what Herman Mashaba was supposed to talk about. His talk, the title of his talk is Economic Freedom of South Africa, The Contradictions. Mm. And the contradictions are that South Africa right now is free. It's a free country, free from apartheid, free from outright racist regime that it had until 1994, but the country which didn't embrace economic freedom, which is still in the clutches of kind of socialist planning, and that makes South Africans poorer. I mentioned that the countries like Botswana or Zambia, they are star performers. They have economic growth 7, 8, 9, 10% per year. South African economic growth is 1% per year. 1%. So they're not catching up even with the population increase. So they're getting poorer, because if the population is growing 2.5% a year, and the economy is growing only 1%. So, and the reason is, again, the same reason. Because Mr. Zuma, Jacob Zuma, the president of South Africa, the only formal education he got was in the high KGB school in Moscow.
Mm.
That's where he met Mr. Putin. That's very interesting. That Mr. Zuma, he was the chief of intelligence of African National Congress, and he was sent to Moscow in 1991, before even the end of apartheid. And so that the people like him, and now he is being accused in corruption. He is sued 27 times for all kind of crimes and misdemeanors, beginning with rape and embezzlement of government property. But he is still in power, and definitely, I think we can see changes after the people like him will go.
Mm. One can only hope.
Yes.
That's for those of you just joining us on the morning show today, I'm very, very happy to welcome back not only Dr. Art Sear, who, of course, joins us quite regularly, but Dr. Yuri Maltsev, who does not join us as often as he should. And it's so such a pleasure to have him with us again, professor of economics at Carthage College. They are both part of the Claussen Center. We were to be speaking today with South African entrepreneur Herman Mashaba, who unfortunately is snowbound in Boston. And so his trip to Carthage was sort of radically reshaped by those unfortunate events. It is still hoped that he may be able to come for at least part of what he was planning to do at Carthage, including the visiting of classes. His public lecture, however, yesterday evening was canceled. We'll hope to speak with him another time. Professor Maltsev, I know that you are just back from your most recent trip to South Africa, which you were saying was your fifth or sixth visit, and this most recent visit also included students, so it was a J-term trip. Tell us more about who went.
Yes, I had 38 students with me.
How many?
38.
Wow.
38. Yes.
Almost a choir.
And I'm thinking that, Greg, maybe it would be good sometime in the future to have a round table discussion with students to see what they think about it. It looks like everybody loves the trip. I mean, I had a very nice feedback on that. And I think that was very educational, because when we stayed in Johannesburg, the biggest city in South Africa, we listened to wonderful, wonderful lectures. We had lectures by Leon Liu, by Eustace Davy, who are the most visible economists in today's South Africa. Mm-hmm. And they spent a lot of their time, and without any honorarium, they did the great pro bono work. We spent the whole Saturday once with them, the seminar on South African economy. Then we visited Soweto. That's where Nelson Mandela, he organized his movement against apartheid. That's where Desmond Tutu, another Nobel Prize winner, lived, actually one block from Nelson Mandela. It was only a little street in Soweto where two Nobel Prize winners, they lived just next door to each other.
Wow.
And so it was very interesting trip from all points of view. Then I, because I my field is transitional economies, That's what I am studying because of my background. I worked on Mr. Gorbachev's reforms back in Soviet Union. And so in South Africa, they're very interested in all this transitional reforms. So I also spoke. I was invited to do a public lecture in Central University of Technology in Bloemfontein. That's the university which awarded Herman Mashaba an honorary doctorate. He is very well known there. Then we had a wonderful lecture by a labor economist, Piet Leroux, in Pretoria, in the capital of South Africa. Educationally, we had a lot. I mean, many students were even complaining that they don't have enough free time because somebody is all the time talking to them. But we also managed to see the animals, to go on safari in Pilanesberg National Park, to see all kind of other animals, seals, and penguins. Not many people realize that the largest world colonies of penguins are in Africa, in South Africa, in a place called Simonstown. That's amazing. The penguin beach, there are tens of thousands of these beautiful birds.
Wow. So how much of South Africa did you end up seeing? I'm sort of trying to imagine just how large the nation of South Africa is. And were you there a couple weeks, several weeks?
We were there for 16 days.
16 days. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, did that allow you to see pretty much kind of a general span of the country, or is that not possible in 16 days?
That's right. Usually we would even make more countries in a visit. For example, last January we went to Mozambique, we went to Kingdom of Swaziland as well as to South Africa, so it was good to compare. This year we were not fortunate because we were planning to visit Kingdom of Lesotho, as well as South Africa. And unfortunately, was the U.S. Department of State issued a travel warning about Lesotho, that the army and police had some skirmishes between each other. And so the U.S. Citizens were advised not to visit. And definitely, for me, on all these trips, the safety of students is number one priority. And so we decided to skip Lesotho. But in the future, we definitely would be happy to go to Botswana, to go to Namibia, because also another legacy that of Carthage as a Lutheran college is that many of these countries, like Tanzania, for example, or Namibia, they are predominantly Lutheran countries. And so when colonialism was over, a lot of students from these countries were educated at Carthage on behalf of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, who was funding this effort. And now we have almost 100 of alumni in Namibia. We have on this last trip, just 2 weeks ago, we saw a wonderful alumni of Carthage, Eliska Buis. She was a champion of Midwest in tennis here, and she was extremely popular young woman at Carthage College, and now she is a very successful teacher of science in one of the best schools in Bloemfontein. And she and her father, they came with a lot of gifts to visit with us, and we had something called braai, which is a cookout in Afrikaans language. And so we had a wonderful cookout with Eliska, with her father. And usually we have all the time we're meeting with alumni, because I think for Carthage students it's also very important to see that their education matters, and matters not only, it's recognized not only here in the United States, but worldwide.
Hmm. I was reading a little bit of the blog entries, which kind of recount some of the major events from this tour, and I'm anxious to go back and read them more thoroughly in all of them. Mm-hmm. One of them made special mention, and I thought he or she wrote so perceptively on the poverty that mm-hmm. they saw, particularly on one particular mm-hmm. day. Can you just say a word about that?
Yes, we visited Soweto. Soweto, that was a hotbed of revolutionary activities against apartheid. That's where Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, and other leaders of anti-apartheid movement came from. Soweto, however, is a very diverse place. I would say I was in Soweto the first time maybe 6-7 years ago, and it was completely different. Today, Soweto is making a lot of progress. You can see a lot of wealthy dwellings. You can see a lot of, it's so much cleaner, so much, the quality of life in many places. However, South Africa, like United States, they experience this influx of people from less fortunate countries. And many of these people, the undocumented workers, say from Zimbabwe, from Mozambique, from other failing countries like that, they come to Soweto and they live in tiny kind of shacks with no water, with no, I mean, the plumbing is outdoors. Then you see a lot of stray dogs, a lot of problems. Having said that, however, I am very optimistic about even that people, because they don't stay there for long. They don't stay there forever. They would go through this experience of abject poverty, which is still more attractive for them than the homelands that they abandoned.
Mm.
So many people don't realize that what we can perceive as abject poverty is an ideal for some. It is something that they think they're better off rather than the places, unsafe places, I would say deadly places, like in Zimbabwe and Mozambique, that they abandoned for that. And I really see that their kids already are going to South African schools. They themselves, they just lived in South Africa. And I met some Zimbabwean entrepreneurs, say, in Pretoria and in Johannesburg, which already did well for themselves.
Hmm. The economic development that we're seeing, I assume much of what makes that possible is the influx of capital from other places. Mm-hmm. Who is at the moment doing the most investment in Africa? I mean, what parts of the world are taking the most intense interest in development opportunities in South Africa?
Well, South Africa, maybe unlike most other parts of Africa, they have their own basis for capital development. And the reason is the mining industries. South Africa is the world richest in gold, the world richest in platinum and diamonds. So that's the kind of already capital is building right there in their country by South African entrepreneurs, and also by people from overseas. Well, the British are very active there. Mm-hmm. The Dutch are very active there. Americans are very active. Last January, we met just in a grocery store. We met a wonderful entrepreneur, an African-American. His name was Harry, from Atlanta, Georgia. From Atlanta, Georgia. He moved to Umhlanga in South Africa, in Zulu-Natal province. He moved there with his startup company, and he started 16 businesses in South Africa. He is providing seed money for South African entrepreneurs. And definitely people like him are doing very well, not only for himself, but for the country, because many people are getting the chance to be successful.
Hmm. It's extraordinary. I mean, the kind of success story, it's amazing that more of us here aren't more aware of it. I mean, you and Professor Sear and your colleagues, obviously, it's your business to know these kind of things. But I feel like you're telling a story that so many Americans, I for one, are just asleep to. We're just not aware of the new Africa.
They are welcome to join me on these tours. We welcome community people, and we have community people. Usually, they're people from older people, the people who are interested in exploring. They can just take it as a class at Carthage College, as a continuous education class, and it's very good when you have a mix of younger people and older people, people with different backgrounds. It also helps Carthage, because some of these people who went on these trips with me today, they are supporters of Carthage College. They're donors. They're participating in our community life at Carthage.
Professor Sear, maybe you could just say a word about the scope of this kind of activity under the Clausen Center, in terms of how many kinds of trips like this occur, and to what kinds of places Carthage students get to go.
Well, the Claussen Center is part of the wider institution, of course, and I must say I am personally, as well as professionally, grateful to President Woodward and the officers and trustees of the college. But the president especially has been very supportive of our work and went out of his way to say so from early in his tenure. The Claussen Center per se does not sponsor overseas trips. We try to reinforce this campus-wide phenomenon, and I believe this last January we had more than a dozen trips overseas, supplemented by the growing, rapidly growing trend, I believe, of students to spend a semester, a summer, shorter or longer periods of time, sometimes an entire year overseas. Eric Hulke, our colleague in modern languages, part of his job is encouraging this. We are fortunate that Steve Chapman, a trustee of the college and a senior executive at Cummins Corporation, endowed the executive in residence program to get specifically to Africa. Tom Claussen, who ran the World Bank as well as before and afterwards Bank of America, developed during his World Bank tenure a very strong interest in Africa. A personal interest. He told me once that if he hadn't gone back to Bank of America for an unusual second round as CEO, he was going to spend his time on private development as well as philanthropy efforts in Africa. Hmm. I have been frustrated that, in contrast to some other areas we've identified for our program, it's been slower going. But we have made progress in developing and encouraging work on Africa. As Yuri said, we have institutionally a strong tradition, especially in Tanzania, Malawi, and Kenya, and that's provided something of a foundation to build on. We do, thanks to Danny Geary, especially, and others in the social work department, we now have a collaborative relationship with a women's support center in Ghana, and our Enactus students, a business service organization, our Enactus students are now working on a continuing basis with that center. So Dave Schlichting and Jennifer Madden in our business department are particularly active in leading Enactus. So there are various things going on, and I spend part of my time trying to be supportive and try to coordinate this diffuse activity.
It's exciting. It's absolutely exciting.
It is, and times are changing very dramatically, as Yuri is, as he personifies, but also has been telling us, our American engagement in Africa is growing quite rapidly.
Right. And I'm realizing now that I think one of the reasons why I have the view that a lot of Americans have of South Africa is because a lot of what I know more currently about Africa comes through certain trips that get taken that are very much humanitarian kinds of trips. So, for instance, my colleague in the music department, Dr. Dene,
yes,
has taken groups to
Namibia.
Yes, and to a small orphanage, and in a sense, that's what we might think of as old Africa. Except, of course, that reality is still very much in place for all kinds of people. I mean, impoverished places that are kind of waiting for this renaissance to reach them, and of course, those trips are tremendously important and many lives are being changed for the better. But that being said, that's not the entire story of Africa, and that there's this other emerging economically vigorous Africa, and one can only hope that vigor will reach out and really touch many, many more lives across the continent.
Exactly, and I would say that you're absolutely right that the trips are good not only for our students to see new places and meet new people, but also to develop the feelings of public service to people who are not as fortunate as they are. And we, for example, one of these last trips, we delivered a lot of humanitarian assistance to an orphanage in Kingdom of Lesotho. Then to Zambia, we had a wonderful raising of funds and resources here from local hospitals. We were delivering even artificial arteries and veins and other medical equipment to the hospital in Zambia, which was staffed by volunteers from Kenosha, Wisconsin, amazingly enough. So that's the Johnson Johnson Wax was very helpful in providing us with a lot of this this humanitarian assistance resources. So it's very important. And my choice of South Africa and sub-Saharan Africa in general is not a random choice, because I've traveled quite a lot. I've been to over 80 countries in the world. But I think that this has the most educational value for our students, because it's a combination of everything, combination of wonderful history of very diverse populations. A lot of cultures are meeting each other over there. Not many people realize that South Africa is the largest home for Indian people outside of India. That Mahatma Gandhi became what he became in South Africa, in Durban, South Africa.
He practiced. He started practicing law there.
That's
correct?
Right. Yes,
he was. It's really a British education.
Yes, and he was. I didn't know about that. And he was also incarcerated by the British. After actually serving as a volunteer in the British Army, in the medical corps of the British Army, he was carrying the wounded British soldiers from the battlefield. So it's an amazing history. It's an amazing ecosystem. It's a beautiful country. Some parts of it, like Cape Town, they look like or even better off, for me at least, than San Francisco, San Diego. Mm-hmm. It's a country with beautiful mountains and jungles and deserts. So for students, it's, I think, and beautiful people. Beautiful people, so generous in sharing their experiences and their views with our students, that I think they benefit from that quite a lot.
One could scarcely ask for more as a visitor and as an educator, too. In the few minutes that remain to us, I'm sorry, just four or five, actually, but we would certainly be remiss if we didn't talk for a moment about the situation in Russia and Ukraine, a different part of the world, although racked by some of the same tensions that we've actually been talking about in some of these other places on the African continent. So where is the situation now, and what is the situation now, and where is it likely to lead? Do we have any way of knowing?
Yes, well, I think Winston Churchill, his famous quip is that Russia is the only country in the world with unpredictable past. So its future, its future is shrouded in clouds. So we cannot predict the future because we don't know what happened. Now we know what happened, and we know what's happening. And it's very sad for me as an ethnic Russian to see how Putin dictatorship is destroying the country that I was born at. That Russia became also an enemy and a threat to its neighbors. Ukraine today is really, it's really very sad that Ukraine, which suffered probably more than any other European country in the 20th century, today is suffering again from the same source, from Moscow. Not many people in the United States heard of Holodomor, which is called the Grand Starvation or Grand Hunger. In the dreadful winter of 1932-1933, Stalin and his cronies, they confiscated all food from Ukrainians in eastern Ukraine, and 9 million people died out of starvation. It was a pandemic hunger, which resulted in mass cases of, I don't know, cannibalism, of whatever. It was just a gruesome part of human history. 6 million which didn't die were deported to Siberia and were murdered there. So 15 million people from eastern Ukraine were exterminated under Stalin in the dreadful winter of 1932-1933. That's why we have so many Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine today. And that's the ticking bomb which was laid by Stalin at that time. So today, Mr. Putin is exploiting this tragedy, the historical tragedy of Ukrainian people. And definitely it's so strange for me to see how the Western leaders are trying to kind of rationalize the absence of support to Ukrainian people, because Ukraine is really it's a nice, very nice country. It's very unfortunate for them that they have such a long border with Russia, and being attacked so viciously, and there is absolutely no. Some people saying, well, from one hand, from another, there is no. From one hand, from another hand, Ukraine is a victim of unwarranted aggression on behalf of Mr. Putin, and the West is if not endorsing it, but it's not doing anything to really help Ukrainian people. United States providing goggles to Ukrainian army of night vision goggles and helmets and socks. So this is this wonderful how to fight Mr. Putin's army with socks and goggles. So this is definitely. And this happened before. In 2008, Putin attacked Georgia with exactly the same results. We have Abkhazia and southern Ossetia as the failed states over there, which were created by Mr. Putin just to prevent Russian people from seeing success of their neighbors in building free societies. So that's the reason, I think. And Mr. Putin recently, he made a point that he can be in Warsaw in 2 days, that he can take over Kyiv in 1 day. Leader of opposition in Russia, Mr. Zhirinovsky, who is a buddy of Mr. Putin, by the way, so it's a phony opposition, he recently demanded that Russia should be restored in the borders of 1850. So that means bring back Alaska. That means Finland. That means Poland. So definitely maybe Mr. Putin does not have a kind of immediate plans for taking over Alaska, but definitely he prompts his cronies to say these kind of things, to create again West as an enemy, because for Mr. Putin, he needs an enemy to justify his dictatorship.
And we're it at the moment.
Yes, that's why I'm organizing, being an ethnic Russian, I'm organizing trips to South Africa rather than to Russia.
Yeah, right. That's a scary place to go right now for more reasons than one. Well, I hope that we'll get to have more conversations about that really critical matter. And in the meantime, you kind of prompted the possibility of us returning to this matter of South Africa with some of the students who went on this trip with you. I think that would be of great interest to many of our listeners. And we join you, of course, in crossing our fingers that Herman Mashaba at some point might be a guest on the morning show again, and we hope that he is able to eventually get to Carthage to at least visit.
We'll get him here. If not this week, he will be coming to the college. He's quite willing to do so.
Very good. Well, we'll hope for that. And in the meantime, very much appreciate your presence today on the morning show, Professor Yuri Maltsev, Professor Art Sear. Great to have both of you here. I think we ended up having a marvelous conversation, even without the esteemed Mr. Mashaba, who we will hope to meet on another occasion. Thank you for being here on the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Ray Cross, who is the president of the University of Wisconsin System, and he is actually visiting the University of Wisconsin Parkside later today and making time in a busy schedule to record an interview with me, which we will air on tomorrow's morning show. So we look forward to that conversation, of course, with looming budget cuts and very much in the news for the UW system. The morning show is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Click on Talk. WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information at carthage.edu. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Partly cloudy skies today, a chance of afternoon sleet, a high of 29 degrees, overnight low of 22 with some freezing drizzle, cloudy tomorrow, high of 33.